morning. May it please the court. Sorry.
Wait till Ms. Brady finds a seat.
Ready?
Ms. Pollack.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elizabeth Pollack, and I am here representing Ms. Ramirez in this case. And the question that the primary question that the court has to answer today is whether or not a woman like Ms. Ramirez, who had no criminal history, no prior experience in drug dealing, stated on the record in the district court that she was unaware that anyone involved in this conspiracy possessed a weapon, whether or not it would be reasonably foreseeable for her to know that other people she was involved with were in possession of firearms. And the simple answer to that question is no, because of the following. This court has previously held that the mere fact of a drug manufacturing conspiracy is not, in and of itself, sufficient to show that a person should...
That's clear. We need to know whether it was reasonably foreseeable to Ramirez.
Correct.
Did the district judge make a finding on that question?
He did.
Whether it was reasonably foreseeable to Ramirez?
He did. And he said that it was he was going to uphold the enhancement because... What he said was that it was the nature of the business. I'm looking on pages 4 through 7.
I assume you're referring to Judge Pratt.
I'm sorry, she, Your Honor. Yes. My fault. I'm in the Central District of Illinois, so I don't practice in front of her. But the judge did find that it was the nature of the business, that's a quote, that firearms are necessarily related with drug distribution. And she also found that 99.9% of drug deals with large quantities have firearms involved in them. And those are really the only factual findings that were made in support of the two-level enhancement under the guidelines.
Did you say that Ms. Ramirez made the statement that she never saw any guns?
In her objection to the pre-sentence report, she denied that she never
knew there were weapons through her lawyer. She never under oath said that, did she?
Well, not in front of the district court, although she did give a proffer, my understanding is, where she cooperated, and she also denied at that time that she had knowledge of the weapons. So the weapons in this case were located in a stash house underneath couch cushions. That's the evidence that was presented.
And weren't there weapons at some other houses that she was connected to?
There were, I believe, three stash houses, and two of them, they found two firearms under the couches in those. Well, actually, the one house on the date that she was arrested, the firearms were under the couch cushions. There is no evidence as to where the firearms were in the other house, where they were discovered. So what the facts tell us, what we know definitively, is that the firearms that were discovered at the stash house on the date of her arrest were hidden under a couch cushion in the living room. What's interesting about Ms. Ramirez, though, is that, and what the government argued in their brief, is that when you have large amounts of drugs and money, that it's inherent that there will be a firearm associated with that. But that's not true, especially when you look at her individually.
Well, there's a pretty high risk of that.
There's a high risk, but that risk in and of itself is not sufficient to find the enhancement. There has to be other evidence, and that's what the Vold case says, is that there has to be absent other evidence that is not sufficient in and of itself to allow the enhancement. And the other evidence here is simply lacking. There's none. When she left that house, the stash house, on the date of her arrest, she had a large amount of methamphetamine and cash in her possession, but no gun. Her apartment, which was where other drugs and the ledger were housed, which she rented in her capacity in the drug conspiracy.
Your brief keeps saying that the defendant didn't have a gun, but that's not the legal inquiry. Inquiry is whether it was reasonably foreseeable that one of her confederates would.
That's correct.
Right. So I'm trying to figure out why that was... And you agree that the judge actually made the reasonable foreseeability finding.
I don't know if the words were stated, but the implication
was...
Well,
the reason I asked that question is because I thought there was some ambiguity in the transcript, right? If the judge had said something like, well, it was reasonably foreseeable to me that people would have carried guns in this kind of transaction, that's a legal mistake. If the judge said it was reasonably foreseeable to Ramirez, that's a finding of fact, and we need to know whether... It was clearly erroneous. And the judge certainly discussed the details of this transaction, the amount of money that was involved, the fact that this was one big stakes transaction among many big stakes transactions. It's not as if the judge said, well, as a matter of law, every drug transaction involves guns, so go away. There were findings about this transaction. And it certainly can't be that as a matter of law, every time a defendant denies knowledge, the judge can't make a finding of reasonable foreseeability. That would just eliminate the judicial role. So what is it that makes the finding clearly erroneous, given the judge's consideration of these particular facts?
Because there were not sufficient facts presented to bolster the finding of foreseeability. The facts that the judge found, it was a colloquy with defense counsel when those facts were established, and it's on pages 4 through 8 of the transcript and the sentencing transcript. And the defense counsel stated and argued, as we did in our brief, that the locations where the firearms were found were not, she did not live there, she was not connected with it, except for a brief moment when she went to pick up drugs and cash and then left. And that was really the only other fact that was found apart from the judge's statements about the nature of the relationship between drug conspiracies and firearms. And in all of the cases that the government cites in their brief, it talks about the amount of drugs and the amount of cash and how higher amounts and more at-risk transactions can lead to an inference that there could be firearms involved, but that in and of itself is not enough. In all of those cases, there were other factors present. For example, there was wiretap evidence where the co-defendants and co-conspirators were overheard discussing the need for firearms to protect their products. There were cases where there was a raid done on another drug dealer's stash house, which is an inherently dangerous activity. All of the evidence in the present case indicated that these transactions were relatively smooth. There is no argument that Ms. Ramirez ever possessed a weapon herself. There is no evidence that any of the co-conspirators ever carried a weapon during any transaction. There is no evidence that a gun was ever shown or brandished or used in any way during any of the drug transactions. So in all these other cases that the government cites to, there is evidence that a defendant either knew or was informed of or was around when other people were carrying these weapons and that they had imputed knowledge of those weapons. But that's not the case here. The only connection between Ms. Ramirez and a firearm is that there were firearms hidden in stash houses where she spent no more than a few minutes at a time. The only concrete instance we have is the date that she was arrested, where it was observed that she was in that stash house for less than 5 minutes. And there's no reason to believe that any person would pick up a couch cushion and look to see if there was a firearm there, or that if she was in the house for that short a period of time, that she should have recognized that there was a firearm there. And what the district court said when making the ruling was simply that, well, I'll uphold the enhancement because that's what makes sense. And there was no specific finding of foreseeability, but the comments made leading up to that finding all had to do with the fact that drug dealing is an inherently dangerous activity and that firearms are often associated with drug dealing and that drug dealing leads to violence and people being harmed. That is the only factual basis that existed for the enhancement in the district court, and it was erroneous to find that that enhancement should have applied for those reasons. There's just not enough. There's no additional evidence to show that this person, and this defendant is who we're looking at, the defendant's foreseeability. This Ms. Ramirez is a green. She's a newbie. She had no criminal history, no involvement with drug dealing in any other capacity in her past, and there's no reason to think that someone like that would have a reason to believe, especially where there's no record of a violence. There's no record of any difficult transactions where guns would be needed for protection. Another example of a case where the large amount of drugs led to a finding that a firearm enhancement was appropriate is where the individuals responsible for the conspiracy were blocking off the street and putting on roadblocks because they were worried about their product being stolen or what have you, and that's not present here. These were smooth, even transactions. She had never seen a firearm and had no reason to believe that anyone else would have seen a firearm. And so for that reason, the two-level enhancement was inappropriate, and the court should reverse the sentence and remand for reconsideration of that, which leads to the second portion of the argument, which is the argument regarding the safety valve application. And safety valve was not raised in the district court, although my position is that it absolutely should have been, and that anybody who represents a criminal defendant charged with a drug offense where the criminal defendant is a Category 1 with no prior criminal history, no leader organizer enhancement, and it could easily have been noted that research from other circuits could have been done, you have to address the issue of that safety valve. And in Ms. Ramirez's case, it could have made a difference between a 160-month sentence, which was below her guidelines range, and an even below mandatory minimum sentence. So it was an important omission, and it constituted plain error. And I see I'm in my rebuttal time.
I don't see how it could be error not to address an issue the parties have never raised. Safety valve reduction is one on which the defendant bears the burdens of both production and persuasion. how could it even in principle be an error not to address that if the defendant never asked for a reduction?
Well, I think that in cases, Ms. Ramirez is a non-English speaker and was relying on...
I don't give a fig about that. Her lawyer was, I trust, an English speaker.
As far as I know.
Right? It sounds to me like you might have a complaint about the performance of the lawyer. I find it very hard to see how you have a complaint about the performance of the judge.
The only thing that I would direct the court's attention to is the recent ruling in United States versus Siegel, which admittedly it is dicta, but this court had stated that a district judge, can be responsible for looking neutrally at the issues not raised by the parties. And it's a stretch, but it is something that is critically important to a defendant like Ms. Ramirez and should have been raised. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Pollack. Ms. Brady.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michelle Brady on behalf of the United States. If I could first address the issue regarding the gun enhancement that was applied in this case, I think it's hard to imagine the court clearly erring in applying that enhancement given the facts of this case. This was a organization that was distributing an incredibly large amount of methamphetamine in the city of Indianapolis. There were three main parties, as set forth in the PSR, who were involved in that. The defendant, Mr. Andrade, and Mr. Ramos, both co-defendants of hers. In this case, the defendant was something of a jack of all trades. She distributed drugs. She picked up money. And I think most importantly, she kept the books for this organization. I think that's important for two reasons. One, it demonstrates how important her role was. She wasn't some mule not to be trusted with the intricate details of the organization. She was very much trusted. Second, I think it's important because the fact that she kept the books certainly demonstrates, as other facts do, but that fact also demonstrates her knowledge of how much money, how much methamphetamine was going through this organization.
Did the district court rely on any of that, though? The actual decision is a little skimpy.
Your Honor, I would agree that there was no absolute statement by the district court that she found reasonable foreseeability to this defendant. I think you can find it in between the lines, though, and I say that...
Yeah, well, findings in between the lines are not there. If Ms. Pollack hadn't conceded that there was such a finding, I would have been very inclined to wonder whether it existed.
Well, I think it is a finding in that at page 8 of the sentencing, the court, after hearing the argument and questioning counsel about how incredibly large this organization was in terms of the amount of money, the amount of drugs involved, that the court says that she's going to overrule the objection to the information in the pre-sentence report regarding the firearms, and she says the law is in favor of the calculations that the probation department has made. And if you look at that
But the only information in the pre-sentence report is that those guns were located where they ultimately were found, and they were concealed in the one instance, and the other we don't know, right?
Well, there were actually three stash houses where there were guns found, Your Honor.
None of them were they laying out in a visible way, or at least there's nothing in the pre-sentence report that says they were.
There's nothing in the pre-sentence report that says one way or the other as to the other two houses.
And there's nothing in the wiretaps or any of the when she's arrested or so forth that shows the use of a gun or the display of a gun, the brandishing of a gun.
That's correct.
So isn't she really relying on this sort of presumption she has where she says that 99.9% of drug deals, suggesting that guns are involved in almost every drug case?
Well, except for the fact that what the judge does say is that the relies on the laws in favor of the calculations probation made. If you look at the addendum to the final PSR, it's quoted in the government's brief at page 4, that final addendum does say what must be proven by preponderance is that the presence of firearms was reasonably foreseeable to her, to the defendant, and it goes on. But I think that's where your finding is, that it was reasonably foreseeable to her. I think this case is very similar.
It's in the addendum.
Yes, Your Honor. In the final PSR and supplemental addendum on March 16, 2012, as quoted in the government's brief at page 4. That's what the judge is referring to, and that's the finding that the judge then made. Looking at the Lustre case, I think...
And within that addendum, it says, Ramirez was an integral member of the distribution cell engaged in daily activities. The FBI organization involved large sums of money and drugs. It doesn't say anything about her presence, the guns being in her presence, or observing them, or being told about them, or anything of that nature.
No, what it says within the PSR is that she was... on numerous occasions, along with her two co-defendants, was surveilled by the DEA agents at two different locations, the Getz Lane location where there was a loaded gun, the Croft Court location where there was also a loaded gun, as well as numerous cell phones, drug ledgers at both those locations. And then, of course, on the day of the arrest that Ms. Ramirez was at the Prestonwood Court address where there were two firearms found at that particular stash house, in addition to the several hundred thousand dollars worth of methamphetamine that was found there, in addition to the $100,000 or so worth of methamphetamine that she had personally just picked up from that stash location. You look at the Lustre case, this court found that the enhancement was appropriate because that defendant had, similar to here, on numerous occasions been to the stash house where guns and drugs were. Not that he saw them, there was any finding that he saw them, had them, used them, etc. Just that he had been there on numerous occasions, just as Ms. Ramirez had, and that defendant knew of the large scope of the drug trafficking activity that was going on in that case. I'd say the difference between Lustre in this case is that there was very strong argument that was made that Lustre was simply a buyer-seller. He wasn't even a co-conspirator, whereas here Ms. Ramirez was found an integral member of that distribution cell, so she was much more closely tied than Lustre was, where that court found that the enhancement should apply on very similar facts. I think it's key as well that the three stash houses that had the loaded firearms. Ms. Ramirez's situation as a member of that distribution cell, that is, those guns were used or were possessed for the protection of the distribution cell. So she wasn't on the other side of the transaction who may not know or wouldn't necessarily have reason to know what the other side of the table was doing. That was her stash house, as much as it was Mr. Ramos's, as much as it was Mr. Andrade's. Not surprisingly, post-arrest, not one of these three defendants knew anything about any guns at those three locations where they were the only three individuals who were frequenting and had access to those three sites. So I think that is an important point, that Ms. Ramirez was very much on the side of the stash house where the guns would be used for her protection, as well as for the rest of the members of her organization. I think that is an important point. If I could, unless there are additional questions on the drug enhancement, I would like to just briefly address the lack of safety valve or a finding of safety valve application here. I think that clearly that matter was forfeited at the district court level. And I think that's important because the fact that it was not brought up...
I don't understand forfeiture. I don't understand how something that depends on a motion by the defendant can ever be reviewed on plain error. That is, suppose the defendant doesn't raise an entrapment defense. That's something the defendant has to do on its own. Is it even conceivable to say, well, it's plain error for the judge not to raise entrapment and instruct on entrapment? Or the defendant doesn't invoke the statute of limitations. Could it even in principle be plain error for the judge not to dismiss the indictment as untimely?
In that case, I don't know that it could, Your Honor. But in this...
Right. Well, as I said to Ms. Pollack, we've held that for the safety valve reduction, the defendant has the burdens of production and persuasion. And if the defendant remains silent, it just necessarily follows that the burdens of production and persuasion have not been met.
Correct, Your Honor. And I
so
would
there
just
can't be any error.
I agree, Your Honor. And I would note the government has now been prejudiced because of that lack of being of bringing that to the court's attention in being able to potentially bring facts or marshal facts that might demonstrate constructive possession of the guns, if not at Prestonwood Court, I think at Croft Court or the Getz Lane address, because clearly the record is somewhat paltry on where the guns were, when Ms. Ramirez was last there, et cetera.
Well, the other issue here of a legal nature is that we don't have any precedent on the interaction between the gun enhancement and the safety valve no gun factor.
That's correct.
So it would have been, I mean, we're even assuming that plain error review applies, we're in the status of having to decide an issue of first impression on plain error review, which is a little dicey.
That's correct, and that is that exactly what we set forth in our briefs, and that is our position here today. Unless there are further questions, I thank you very much for your time. I'd ask you to affirm the sentence.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.